these days that much more piquant by knowing that the Conference on Disarmament has not successfully negotiated anything since then for the past 20 years, even its own work program. The third time of exhilaration for me was when the General Assembly, essentially sitting at head of state and government level at the World Summit 2005 on the UN's 60th anniversary, unanimously endorsed the concept of the state's responsibility to protect, R2P, populations at risk of genocide and other mass atrocity crimes, a concept which my colleagues have been centrally involved in developing in the International Commission that I co-chaired with Ramesh as one of its members, he'll be speaking to us later today, a few years earlier, and have been advocating ever since, as Russell said, in the hope that once and for all, as an international community, we can eradicate the shame of the Holocaust, the shame of Rwanda, the shame of Srebrenica, the shame of Darfur, the continuing shame of Syria and Iraq these days, the Boko Haram in Nigeria. But exhilaration was reinforced when R2P was invoked as the rationale for the intervention in Libya in 2011, which unquestionably saved scores of thousands of lives that would otherwise have been lost, as so many millions of lives have been lost in the past. The trouble is that for every high in the world of the UN, there does seem to be an accompanying low. And this certainly happened with R2P, Responsibility Protect, very soon after that Libyan decision I've just mentioned, when the US, UK and France decided to militarily pursue an open-ended regime change agenda in Libya, and were perceived as a result by other members of the Council as overreaching the much narrower civilian protection mandate they'd been granted, with the result that the Security Council became totally paralysed over the even worse atrocity crime situation unfolding in Syria, which paralysis, in that context at least, if not elsewhere, has continued to this day. While in all my years of public life, there is no single institution that I have found more exhilarating at its best, I don't think there's anything more debilitatingly frustrating at its worst than the UN. The Security Council has, as we know, all too often been less a vehicle for high-order statesmanship than the prisoner of great power manoeuvring. The General Assembly is all too often a theatre for empty rhetoric. Not that we're unused to that in this country, thinking of what's going up the hill at the moment. The Economic and Social Council, most of the time, is a dysfunctional irrelevance. And the Secretariat, for all the brilliance, all the dedication of a host of its individuals, alarmingly inefficient a lot of the time. I certainly have to acknowledge that my own efforts over the years to advance the cause of internal UN reform have been about as quixotic and unproductive as anything that I've ever tried to do. I'm talking about reform of secretariat structures to reduce duplication, waste and irrelevance, reform of personnel practices to ensure that the best people really are in the right jobs, and above all, of course, reform of the structure of the pinnacle of the whole system, the Security Council, to ensure that it began to reflect the world of the 21st century and not that of the middle of the last century. The difficulties and frustrations that we all have from time to time with the UN should, I think, be seen as part of a larger problem of achieving global public goods through collective action. On the one hand, we know that the countries on this globe are more interconnected and more interdependent in more ways than they've ever been. Economic interdependence, not least between the old and new geopolitical giants, US and China, is becoming ever more inescapable. Innovation in communications technology, ever more unstoppable, and problems with our passports, ever more overwhelming. That's to say, those problems as described by Kofi Annan in those terms a few years ago, which do cross traditional state boundaries and are manifestly beyond the capacity of any state, however big and powerful, to solve unilaterally. Problems including climate change, nuclear disarmament, terrorism, piracy, major organized international crime, health pandemics, refugee management, not to mention some major trade and financial imbalances. But the other side of the coin is that as interconnected we are, as we are, we're also still profoundly disconnected. Cooperative international governance of the kind we need to effectively address so many of these problems is of course not totally lacking, but it's still very far from being an instinctive habit of mind among the world's policy makers and decision makers, including those looking after us here in this country, I have to say at the moment. Meeting the challenge of improving global governance is about as impossibly big a task as there is. There are five big gaps that still need to be closed, which my ANU colleague Ramesh, here with us, I've already mentioned him, writing with Thomas Weiss in their superb book Global Governance and the United Nations in 2010, gaps which they've identified as knowledge gaps, normative gaps, policy gaps, institutional gaps and compliance gaps. And the truth is that we have, as an international community, so far only filled any of these gaps very erratically and incompletely, and there's a huge amount yet still to be done. Let me say a few words about each of them. Starting with knowledge gaps, the first requirement for getting something done about an international problem is ensuring that all the relevant players know that it exists. The UN system, with its multiple organs and agencies, has, of course, generated an enormous amount of information and analysis across its three broad areas of activity, peace and security, human rights and development, both directly and through, also, the Blue Ribbon expert commissions and panels that it's regularly established. But still gaps do exist. In conflict prevention, for example, the really critical need is there be detailed knowledge of the factors at work, political, economic, cultural, personal, in each particular risk situation. The basic point about conflict is that it's always context-specific. Big overarching theories, whether cast in terms of the clash of civilizations or ancient ethnic enmity or economic greed or economic grievance or anything else, those theories may be good for royalties, they may be good for undergraduate lectures, not to mention keynote speeches, and to be fair, may also be quite helpful in identifying particular explanatory factors that should certainly be taken into account in trying to understand the dynamics of a particular situation. But those big overarching theory approaches never really do seem to work very well in sorting between those situations which are combustible and those which are not. For that, you really do need detailed, field-based, case-by-case analysis, not making assumptions on the basis of experience elsewhere or what's gone before, but looking at what's under your nose right now. And this, I have to say, is an area where the performance of governments and intergovernmental organisations is incredibly patchy. Sometimes, including with the UN's Department of Political Affairs, which is the primary organ doing this, sometimes first rate, but more often lamentably inadequate. But it's also an area in recent years where a lot of the gap has actually been filled by international NGOs, like Human Rights Watch, my own international crisis group, often working with, I have to say, good academic consultants or secondees. It's by no means an optimal solution, but that kind of field-based, hands-on, granular ground research has contributed importantly to some of the what has been, overall, a better international performance on conflict and resolution over the last couple of decades than has been the case in the past. Moving on to normative gaps, knowing about an actual or emerging international problem is one thing, but having enough concern to want to take some action in response to it is something else, particularly if it might involve the expenditure of national blood or treasure. One of the most crucial factors in determining whether there will be an appropriate response is the existence or absence of relevant international norms. That's to say, generally accepted standards of proper behaviour for the kind of situation in question, especially as recognised and embodied in UN resolutions and declarations at the soft end of the normative spectrum, or as embodied in conventions and treaties at the harder end. The UN, may not win plaudits in many contexts, but given its universal membership, it does have an incredibly important norm-setting role. Whenever all or the great majority of its members do agree on what are appropriate responses. The complete elimination of nuclear weapons is a normative goal, which I guess is unhappily only describable as work in progress at the moment. As perhaps still the case with other major issue areas like responding to climate change and corruption and global poverty. But there are some recent examples of normative gaps being significantly filled in the peace and security area. The emergence of strong international sentiment against landmines and cluster bombs through the Ottawa and Oslo treaty processes are two of them. But the one closest to my heart is what I've already mentioned, the rapid evolution over the last decade of responsibility to protect norm, recognising that mass atrocity crimes, genocide, ethnic cleansing, other major crimes against humanity and war crimes occurring within sovereign states are not no one's business, but everyone's business and simply can't be ignored. A great deal still needs to be done to ensure the effective implementation of that norm in practice, but I think it's true that no government these days can be heard to argue anything like what they used to argue sotto voce, if not loudly, that sovereignty is a license to kill. The best evidence of that normative shift, I think, is not only the statements that continue to be made in the annual debates in the UN General Assembly that have taken place every year now since 2009, but the fascinating fact that even since the breakdown of consensus over Libya in 2011, to which I've referred, there have been in the Security Council since the Libyan resolutions, just those few years since the resolutions in March 2011, there have been 30 separate resolutions explicitly utilising and endorsing basic R2P principles, 30 of them, dealing with country situations like Sudan, South Sudan, Mali, Central African Republic. Admittedly, a lot of those resolutions just going to the so-called first pillar of R2P, states' responsibility to protect its own citizens, but the normative commitment is in fact there, and I think that's encouraging. Coming thirdly to policy gaps, knowledge that something's a problem and a concern to do something about it won't be enough by themselves to generate effective action. The other requirements are understanding of an agreement about the right policy levers and, of course, getting agreement about pulling them. Having the institutional capacity to deliver that policy response and, of course, that constant, indispensable, implicit element in filling all these gaps, having the political will to do so. The most important single UN mechanism for harnessing global policy commitment around particular issues are the thematic summits, which happily it continues to regularly convene. Three big ones coming up over the next 12 months. The UN summit to adopt the post-2015 development agenda in New York in September, just next month. Conference, of course, of parties of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change coming up in Paris in December, and the first World Humanitarian Summit, which is scheduled for May next year in Istanbul. In the peace and security area generally, there are a well-established set of existing institutions which can properly be described as having policy-making responsibility, in the sense of the capacity to pick and choose between appropriate response options and at least notionally to energise the necessary action. The problem with a number of these policy institutions is not so much in their formal structure, their formal role, but their actual practical delivery, a classic example being the Geneva Conference on Disarmament, which I've already mentioned. For present purposes, I think the important point to note is that the international system cries out for a workable global policy formulation mechanism that recognises the reality that in the contemporary world, security, economic and other major policy problems, like saving the global environment, do overlap. And a mechanism that will actually consolidate ideas, debate options and generate policy conclusions that have an inherent credibility, an inherent momentum and universal take-up potential. I think the best available practical solution for filling this policy gap that I've just described, certainly from Australia's perspective, lies in the further evolution of the G20. From being, as it started out, a meeting of finance ministers and central bank governors in 1999, to an all-purpose, hopefully global policy formulation and advocacy body, meeting, bringing together the major players in the world of the world of the 21st century, meeting regularly at head of government level, as it now has done since the onset of the global financial crisis in 2007. There is inevitably some concern that one hears around UN circles that although the G20 has so far focused more or less entirely on economic affairs, it won't be long before some major political crisis thrusts security issues onto its agenda, and that that might sideline the Security Council in the process. If that energises the Security Council to start seriously reforming its own composition, then so much the better. But it's important, I think, to put this in perspective, to recognise that while the Security Council's role under the UN Charter is crucial to the maintenance of a rule-based international order, what we should be talking about with the G20 is policy formulation, advocacy, coordination, rather than formally making, implementing and enforcing executive action, which is Security Council's business, in the peace and security area at least. There's room, and in my judgment, the need in international governance to have both. Institutional gaps. In many different contexts, there are huge gaps in institutional capacity to deliver effective results. Even when there's knowledge of a problem, normative consensus that something needs to be done about it, and available policy strategies that will actually make a difference. Many of the institutions in which we've invested responsibility for today's most pressing global questions are frankly, manifestly not fit for purpose. Ultimately, the most crucial institution for the maintenance of global peace and security is again the UN Security Council, the only international body, after all, with full, notionally universally accepted, executive decision-making authority. But I have to say again, its composition, together with the veto powers vested in the five permanent members, of course reflects far more the power realities of 1945 than those of 2015. If the Security Council remains unreconstructed and unreformed, I genuinely believe it's only a matter of time, maybe another 15 years or so at best, before its credibility and authority will diminish to dangerous levels in the eyes of most of the world. Having worked this particular issue for a number of years and played with every possible formula for its resolution, I have to concede that this is not one of those problems for which intellectual creativity is going to be much help. It does all boil down to whether the political will can eventually be found among enough of the key players to make the necessary compromises to keep this key linchpin of the international system in place. The second most important crucial institutional gap to fill, in my judgment, is strengthening the regional organisations, which both the UN Charter and practical experience tell us are crucial, certainly in the maintenance of international peace and security. The UN's own regional commissions, like ESCAP for Asia and the Pacific, have been, I have to say, with apologies to any of you who might have been involved in them, comprehensively underwhelming. But there are also obvious weaknesses, and even notionally the most advanced and sophisticated intergovernmental organisations, like the European Union, still, of course, anything but an effective union in terms of its foreign policy clout, although every now and again it does show glimmers, as well as the important but still very incompletely developed African Union and ASEAN, all the way through from those to the barely functioning SAARC in South Asia. Despite their origins in economic cooperation, all these organisations do have very important roles to play in peace and security issues, and global and regional policy issues more generally, and I think we'll need to have to take up more of the burden in this respect in the future. The main hope for progress in the Indo-Pacific, although still in its infancy, is the East Asia Summit, which brings together in ways that neither APEC nor the ASEAN Regional Forum do, all the key players at leadership level, with the mandate to discuss the full range of economic, security and other key issues and the interconnection between them. Finally, a word on compliance gaps. The most profound inherent weakness of international governance is its inability to enforce compliance with specific decisions or broader norms generated by international bodies. Even the Security Council itself, again, whose decisions are supposed to have at the formal level the force of law, has to rely on individual member states to apply the diplomatic isolation or economic sanctions or, in extreme cases, forceful military action on which it might agree. The decisions of the International Court of Justice are not self-executing, and in any event apply only, in that case, to those states who accept its jurisdiction. The compliance weaknesses inherent in the operation in practice of the International Criminal Court are well known to us all. Here, as with most of the other gaps that I've been identifying, there are no quick and easy fixes, just a long, grinding process of identifying areas where greater cooperation is required and encouraging government to provide it. Recognising that of all the mechanisms available, the UN family of institutions is by far the most comprehensive in scope and must remain absolutely central. There are actually a lot of good news stories that continue to be able to be told and should be told about the UN at its best. And I really do think it's very important that the next generation of young activists and enthusiasts be able to tell those stories, because there's so many of our fellow citizens who are sceptical or cynical or just plain ignorant about what the UN does, starting, unhappily, with a number of members of our present governments. Although I have to say Prime Minister Abbott does seem to have had a little bit of an awakening since the MH17 affair and the visibility that our Security Council seat gave to our justified outrage at the shooting down of that plane over Ukraine, an awakening and awareness that multilateral institutions, the UN in particular, might not be a complete waste of time and money. I have to say that his attitude up until then rather reminded me of a conversation I once had with US Secretary of State James Baker, when I said to him rather cheekily that the trouble with you Americans, Jim, is that you have a reflexive prejudice against the UN. He thought for a moment, he said, "No, God, it's not a reflexive prejudice, it's a considered prejudice." A bit of that around still. Australia, in fact, punched well above its weight during our 2013-14 occupancy of a non-permanent Security Council seat, as indeed we have in the past, although we had to wait an unconscionable 27 years for that last opportunity. While not every position taken on the instructions of the Australian government was universally admired, especially on Israel-Palestine issues, I have to say, among the many plaudits justly won by Ambassador Gary Quinlan and his extraordinarily competent team, both for upfront and highly productive behind-the-scenes work, were for the roles we played in winning support for that path-breaking couple of resolutions on humanitarian access in Syria, facilitating the destruction of that country's chemical weapons stockpile, updating and strengthening the Council's anti-terrorism response framework, securing the Council's first ever comprehensive resolution on small arms and light weapons, resetting the approach to sanctions implementation, and playing a leading role in bringing the North Korea situation onto the Council's agenda. And I think all of us ought to be very congratulatory of the role played by Gary and others in doing all of that. It was a great period. This year's 70th anniversary of the UN is a great opportunity to paint the good news story about the UN on a broader canvas. And those of us who are passionate about the organisation should be doing just that. One of the things we should be telling people, for a start, because most people have the faintest idea, is just how many different roles are played by the UN, by the multiple departments, programs, organs and agencies within the UN system. Across the whole spectrum of issues and areas, from peace and security, between and within states, to human rights, human security more generally, health, education, poverty alleviation, disaster relief, refugee protection, people and drug trafficking, heritage protection, climate, environment, and many others as well. Most people don't begin to appreciate just how many of these agencies have performed outstandingly well for many decades. Take, for example, the World Food Programme, which feeds now in war zones, natural disasters, health emergencies, and chronically poor regions, over 100 million people across 80 countries. UNICEF, which has played a central role in more than halving deaths of children under five over the last 25 years. UNHCR, which has helped over 50 million refugees restart their lives since 1951, and continues to care, High Commissioner for Refugees, for more than 20 million of the world's most vulnerable people spread across 116 countries. WHO, UNAIDS, the Global Fund, who played the central role in fighting and winning the worldwide battle against HIV/AIDS. And the much more prosaic but critical work of multiple agencies, from ICAO, Civil Aviation Organization, to ITU, Telecommunications Union, WIPO, World International Property Organization. Organizations like that who provide the soft infrastructure, so-called, of the global economy by negotiating universally accepted technical standards in areas such as statistics, trade law, customs procedures, intellectual property protection, aviation, shipping, telecommunications. The other big story we should be telling, and I'll conclude with this material, is how really very little, comparatively, it all costs. Let me give you some figures which put the whole UN enterprise in context and which you might find helpful in silencing some of the doubters and the sceptics. The core functions of the UN, leaving aside the peacekeeping missions, but counting at least everything that goes on in the big headquarters in New York, the big UN offices in Geneva and Vienna and Nairobi, and for what they're worth, the five regional commissions that are spread around the world. That currently involves the employment. Those core functions currently involve the employment of some 41,000 people at a regular budget cost of $2.75 billion a year. That sounds a lot, but maybe not quite so much when you realise, to take examples from just three of the UN's 193 member states, the Tokyo Fire Department spends nearly as much as that each year alone. The Australian Department of Human Services, with fewer staff, spends about $3.5 billion more than that, and New York City spends about $75 billion more than what we spend on the core functions of the UN system. If you then add to those UN core functions its related programs and organs, like the UN Development Programme, UNDP, and the UNHCR, High Commissioner for Refugees, if you add also its peacekeeping activities, which now involve over 120,000 international military, police and civilian peacekeepers, the total UN system cost jumps quite a lot, but it's still just around $30 billion a year, which again sounds a pretty big number, and it is, but not so much when you realise that it's much less than a third of what the US military spent each year for years on end on the Afghanistan conflict alone. And even more so, and this is probably my favourite statistic, when you remember that $30 billion is less than the amount that Wall Street bankers paid themselves in bonuses in 2007, the year before the global and financial and economic meltdown. The whole family of UN secretariat and related entities, together with the current peacekeepers, adds up to about 236,000 people worldwide. Not a small number, again, but maybe one that's put in better context when you know that it's not many more than the 191,000 people around the world now selling Starbucks coffee. That's not even very good coffee. And just one-eighth of the 1.9 million staff employed by McDonald's and its franchisees worldwide. So the bottom line in all this is not only that if the UN ever ceased to exist, we'd have to reinvent it, but up its fabulous value for what the world spends on it. Yes, there's lots of frustrations. Yes, it could do better still in all sorts of ways, including those I've spelt out. But what we always need to remember in those immortal words, perhaps the most famous and respected of all its Secretaries General, Doug Hammarskjöld, that the UN was created not to bring us to heaven, but to save us from hell. It's up to all of us, not only government policymakers around the world, but grassroots citizen organisations like the UNAA that exist to keep them honest and engaged to ensure that the UN never flags in its mission. And that mission, at its core, is to save the world's most vulnerable people from hell, and in the process, through constant attention to cooperative efforts to solve the world's most intractable problems, to bring us all at least just a little bit closer to heaven. Thank you.